Started writing his published books when he was about 32, and in the 10 years before he died, he ended up publishing 26 books, many of which are classics today, very highly regarded. You think there'd been a few ringers in there, but most of them are really very remarkable productions. In addition to that, he compiled in the English translation, it's a 4,000-page journal. Started writing that a little earlier. He spent about 15 years on his journal, and in 15 years he compiled 4,000 pages in the English translation. We've been working on him last week, and so this is the beginning of our second week dealing with Kierkegaard's thought. So I know some of you were not here last week, so you didn't get the introduction to him. So I'll give a little quick introduction to Kierkegaard. His writing, his published works started about 1840, 1842, and then went to his death in 1855. His works are of a great variety and diversity. They're not all the same piece of cloth. And he has different temperaments depending on which books you're looking at. He has a very significant work devoted to literary criticism. He has very significant work devoted to philosophical issues. Perhaps his greatest book, by all considerations, would be a book he published in 1846 called The Concluding Scientific Postscript to the Philosophical Fragments. About a 500-600-page book. So he addressed philosophical questions. And he also wrote a large number of books on doctrinal issues in the Christian church, on sin, on original sin, on the sense of guilt, and on death. He also produced a large number of books devoted to collections of sermons he never preached. See, he never was ordained there. He did do a little preaching as one without authority. You've heard himself as one without authority. But these were collections of his Christian discourses, which were explications of biblical texts. You know, kind of old-fashioned sermons on Bible texts. Hear those anymore? Every now and then? Sermon on a Bible text? That's what they are. And there's a large number of those as well. Probably the best known one is the one entitled Christian Discourses. That was published in 1850. So there's a variety of works, and the temperaments change. There are times in his authorship when he's very measured and very cautious and very deliberate and very dense in his explication of what he's trying to express. And there's other times when he's far more freewheeling, less responsible, more rambunctious. And those writings largely are found in the late period, and that's the ones we're working with. We're working mostly with the stuff he printed from 1850 to 1855. Very rambunctious writings. They also are writings that are devoted to a large degree to an attack on the established church in Denmark at the time. And the question for us, the question for everybody, I suppose, that reads that, is whether or not his complaint about the church in 1850 to 1855 applies today. The things that he worried about, the things that made him nauseous. One point he said, in eternity, pastors will be what prostitutes were on earth. The things that made him sick, disgusted him, are they any longer relevant? Or has the church emerged, progressed to a point of sophistication and faithfulness to the tradition, where what Kierkegaard worried about no longer is our worry? That's what about anybody that reads that stuff has to finally decide. So what we're looking at, what we've done, last week we looked at two little books, which I would recommend as the wonderful start into Kierkegaard. And even if you didn't want to understand Kierkegaard, I'd recommend that every Christian should read that book, this little blue book. I think there's one left in the bookstore. It's called For Self-Examination, and then the second book that's published with it in this little slim volume. Each book is about 80, 90 pages long. The second one is called Judge for Yourselves. I think there's nothing like it. Now, I've almost read everything in Christendom, not quite, but I had never seen a book like that book. That book is remarkable. It's without peer. Would recommend that. And we worked on that last week. We spent 3 days on those two little books. And then we looked at, on Saturday, we looked at Fear and Trembling, which was written, that's the earliest one we looked at, and it was one of his synonymous works that he published under another person's name, a fictitious person, and that was called Fear and Trembling, and that was a book about Genesis 22 and Abraham's near sacrifice of Isaac. And now this week, what we're going to do is look at two other books. One published in 1850, the one we're going to start on tonight, called Training in Christianity. This is a wonderful book. A wonderful book. And I hope that you develop a desire to read it one day in your life. From the two times we have together on this book. We'll look at the first half of it tonight, and tomorrow we'll look at the other half of it, hopefully. And then on Wednesday and Thursday, we're going to look at a book that was the last one published, which is a collection of newspaper articles. And that book is called Attack on Christendom, which is his collection of, oh, there must be 100 newspaper articles in that little book. There are just one-page, two-page ditties complaining about the way the church was going in his day. So we'll look at that book on Wednesday and Thursday. And then on Friday, we'll look at a video that was put together by Malcolm Muggeridge about 12 years ago in a series called The Third Testament. Some of you may have seen it. It hasn't been re-aired with any great regularity, so if you saw it 12 years ago, it may be fun to see it again and see what you remember. So we'll look at that on Friday, and then a couple other little things, but there won't be a major workshop on any of his writings. We'll have Friday to see the video, Malcolm Muggeridge. The nice thing about the video, Muggeridge doesn't do as good a job as I do on Kierkegaard's thought. But Muggeridge is in Copenhagen when he does his thing. So you get to see the countryside. He takes you out to the places where Kierkegaard liked to sit and meditate and show you the museum and different things, Copenhagen. How many of you have visited Copenhagen? How many of you visited the Kierkegaard library? One of you! Oh, okay. That's good. All right, you get to see some of that on there. And Muggeridge, he's kind of a character anyway, so that makes it interesting. But basically, the reason we're looking at it is to get a little bit of a feeling for Denmark and Copenhagen. And Muggeridge has maybe two or three things that he says there that are worth thinking about, too. So, but anyway, so we'll do that on Friday. And that'll be a lot of fun, I think. So that's kind of how we're going. Let me say what I'm trying to do in the class at this time together. I'm trying to identify what Kierkegaard called his corrective. He said in his journals, I have nothing new to say. All I have to bring is a corrective. To call to remembrance things that you knew and you forgot. That's it. Simple as that. So what I'm trying to do is identify what that corrective was that he had to bring. And the way I'm trying to do that is I see four things in the corrective, and we're going to be looking at the third one tonight, the third and the fourth one this week. Four correctives, and they're in the image of a wedge. He drives four wedges in at the church. Right? The first wedge he drives in is he tries to split apart the identification that's taken place between faith and comfort. Drive a wedge in there so that comfort is no longer identical with the Christian faith. Now, when you drive a wedge in, you don't eliminate the two. You just spread them apart a little bit and maintain their distinct integrity so that you no longer can say that the Christian faith is about comfort. There's some comfort in it, but the Christian faith is not essentially about comfort. So he drives that wedge in. And that's what I see him doing in the books Judge for Yourself for Self-Examination. The next wedge he drives in is in the book Fear and Trembling. And there it's a wedge between the Christian faith and morality. Now, he's not trying to say that to be a Christian, to hold the Christian faith, is to be immoral. There are times appropriate for behaving morally, but it's wrong to say that a Christian is a moral person. Morality is not identified with the Christian faith. Just wrong. And so he titles his book, Fear and Trembling. If you really believe that the Christian faith is not identical with the moral life, being a good boy, a good girl, being an upright citizen, being a venturous social reformer, I mean, you know, put whatever cast you want into what it means to be moral, if you say that that's not what it is to be a Christian, you can't identify those two, then you venture out in fear and trembling. Because one way you have of securing your Christian life is say, well, for Pete's sakes, at least we give money to the food bank. Don't close us down. Don't take away our tax-exempt status. In West Seattle, I'm a Lutheran pastor in West Seattle, we have one of the largest food banks in the country. And it's all funded by churches. It's one of the only food banks in the country. We run through a ton of food a day out of that food bank. And so when people complain about, well, what's First Lutheran Church West Seattle? I say, well, we look what we're doing with the food bank. They go, yeah, the food bank. This will close you down right now, give you another week or two. So if you don't have that association with something that's morally stellar, then you're moving out in fear and trembling. Because you have no way to justify yourself. Or do you? Okay, that's the second wedge. The third wedge we're going to start looking at tonight is a wedge that he drives in between the Christian faith and knowledge. To be a Christian is not to know everything that's essential for living this life. Knowledge is not equated with being a Christian. Having your head straight does not constitute being a Christian. And so the book Training in Christianity, in my judgment, is devoted to that wedge, trying to drive that wedge in. Now, a Christian knows something. Again, it's just a wedge. It's not a hacksaw. It's not severing these two things, but it's spreading them apart and saying that they're not identical one with the other. There's some knowledge in being a Christian. But being a Christian is not equated with that knowledge, whatever that knowledge is. And he's got a whole raft of things here that come under the rubric of knowledge. Understanding. Christian doesn't understand everything. Christian doesn't understand much of anything. Or your presentations aren't logically impeccable. Or that being the life of a Christian isn't filled with rationally acceptable ways of being. He's got a raft of things that kind of fall into the category of knowledge. It's a little bit elastic, but I think we can work with it. And then the last wedge that he drives in, and this corrective that he brings, that we'll look at in the book Attack on Christendom, is the wedge between the Christian faith and community. To be a Christian is not identical with being in a community. Now, that's not a hacksaw. It's not eliminating community from the Christian faith, but it's saying it's not the center. Something else is at the center of Christian faith. And the thing that runs through all of these wedges, these four wedges, Spinoza said, omnes determinatio est negatio, right? We all remember that. You don't understand the meaning of something unless you see what it's contrasted with. So I'm saying he's been driving these wedges in. What does he want to put in its place? If he doesn't like these things stuck together, why does he want them pulled apart? All four of those wedges are in there in order to promote the individual. Now, it's very crucial for us to understand what kind of individualism Kierkegaard is getting after. He's not getting after a narcissistic individualism. You read Lash's book, you know, the narcissistic culture, which that came out about 8-10 years ago. What he describes, that kind of individualism, is not the kind of individualism that Kierkegaard's getting into. He's getting into instead what, I'd borrow a word from his book, Sickness Unto Death, a word, potentiated. He's looking for a potentiated individual, an empowered individual. And he fears in all these, if you let the faith become identified with comfort, if you let it become identified with morality, if you let it become identified with knowledge, if you let it become identified with the community, the self becomes less powerful. And if the self is less powerful than it could be, then nothing works right anymore. Nothing in the faith, nothing in the world, the whole thing. That's the linchpin. If you take Kierkegaard's individualism away from him, the whole thing crashes in on him. Okay? So behind the corrective, which I think can be identified with these four wedges, behind that corrective is this effort to promote an individualism, not a narcissistic individualism where you want to be gratified. You want to be the best consumer you could be. That's kind of a take-up on the Army commercial. Be all that you can be. The best consumer that you can be. That's kind of this narcissistic individualism. Kierkegaard is not interested in that at all. He's interested in bringing vitality and invigorated living to the single individual. Now, when we look at the wedge that he drives in on the attack in Christendom between the faith and the church, we're going to look at some of his statements from his journals on what he thinks the church is. Very interesting. I know of nobody that has his vision of what the church is supposed to be. I mean, it is just off the wall. But I'm telling you that he's got a vision for the church. So, I mean, he wants the individual to be potentiated. One reason for it, it's not a major reason, but it's one, is so that the church can be stronger when you're together. If you're impotent apart, you're not going to become strong when you're together, according to Kierkegaard. Now, one of his modern-day students, Rollo May, he thinks Kierkegaard's dead wrong on that. It goes just the other way around. If you're impotent alone, when you get together, you can become strong. Harris says, the only way you can be strong as a group is if you're strong by yourself in the first place. So we'll look at that and see what he has to say in a little more detail on Wednesday and Thursday. So that's kind of what I see him up to and what we want to try to look at together. Now, what I've also been doing along, we look at some passages in the book, and I encourage you, the books are in the bookstore, and you can go and buy them. They're all paperbacks, they're about $8, $9, and you could do worse with your money. So, you know, splurge. What the hell? Throw caution to the wind. Buy a book! How about it, huh? So there's a few in there, you know, you can... How was that? You tell Dave what I did. Yeah, well, that was pretty good, wasn't it? Yeah, he's worried about me pitching these books. Anyway, you can buy the book and kind of follow along. Some of these passages are a little hard to follow just by hearing. But so we're going to do that. And then I usually have some little handouts. And today we're going to look at a couple from the journals again. The journals, by the way, are kind of the key to Kierkegaard. Because about half of his authorship, half of these 26 books, were written under pseudonyms. But everybody knew Kierkegaard wrote them. He had these fictitious authors that somehow were to tell you something about the book. Like the one we looked at Saturday, A Fear and Trembling, the author of that book was Johannes de Salento, or John the Silent. And what that did, see, that told you something very important about the book, because the two things that Kierkegaard was most struck by in the story of Abraham's near sacrifice of Isaac was, first of all, that Abraham was willing to murder. And secondly, and most importantly, because of the pseudonym, Abraham was silent about why he was. Genesis 22 does not tell you why he decided to do that. God told him to, but he doesn't say why he was willing to be obedient. He was silent about it. And that really struck Kierkegaard. So the pseudonym is a key kind of to what the book... The journals were intended at the end, the last 5 years before he died, he went and he edited his whole journal because he did want it to be printed. And he wanted it to be, this is what I myself really believe is true. So the journals now have kind of been a key to the authorship. So we kind of get little snippets out of the journals. Unfortunately, well, it's wonderful the journals are all printed now in English, so those of us who don't know the Danish can read them. And there are 7 nice big volumes from the University of Indiana. They cost $50 a piece. Couldn't use those for a class. So what I've done is I've just Xeroxed little snippets out, and you can take those away and have a chance to look at the journals that way. I think there's only one person around here that has the journals, one in this community, and he's nearly crazy. No, not, well, I do, but I'm not a, really, a, you know. There's somebody who lives here regularly that has these journals, and he is just about lost all modicum of sanity, so you can't see that as a pitch for buying the thing. And the library has one, the library has the first volume of the journal, so you can go in there and look at it and see kind of what the format is, and just imagine seven others sitting there alongside of it. Big thing. Okay? But anyway, so I've handed those out, and the one we're going to look at tonight is Thoughts on Death, because I think it connects with this first part of the training in Christianity. And then we'll look at the little thing on the crushed will and the thought games. That's the entry 6966. That directly plays into this wedge that's being driven between the Christian faith and knowledge. Full size, just the one here. How many didn't get it? I can get you copies. Maybe I can get you copies tomorrow. If you'd come back. Would you come back? Yeah. About 15. Okay. How are we doing on the little ditty? Same number? Doesn't have that? More?
Don't put it up here.
Oh, okay. Yeah, 15 or 20 of those two. It's up to you, Jody.
If we can go get them?
Okay, all right. Look at that, folks. You come back, you'll get them. Even if you didn't want to come for the next session, we'll have them sitting on there. You just come and grab your slips of paper and run. Okay? Okay, so that's what we're going to look at. All right, I want to try to get a few passages out now from the book Training in Christianity. Again, the thing I see happening here is a wedge being driven between the Christian faith and knowledge. On page 36, there's this one-liner. About six lines down from the top. It is true enough that history furnishes knowledge in abundance, but knowledge demolishes Jesus Christ. It is true enough that history furnishes knowledge in abundance. You collect all kinds of information about the past, but knowledge demolishes Jesus Christ. Our century has seen an incredible literary achievement known as the quest for the historical Jesus. It's an incredible literary achievement. You can just dazzle looking at what Albert Schweitzer and James Robinson and Helmut Kester and what these people have done. It's incredible. Trying to find out what he's like. Given the reliable historical record, not just appealing to sacred writ, but whatever other thing, try to get a picture of what he was really like. Kierkegaard says, it is true enough that history furnishes knowledge in abundance, but knowledge demolishes Jesus Christ. Now, how can that be? Why in the world? Wouldn't you think it kind of help? Help Jesus. Learn a little bit more about him, you know? One of my teachers at the seminary, you know, I'm trying to justify archaeological digs and historical research and all that, saying, how important is Jesus to you? Most important thing, right? Then you can't do enough study trying to find out what he was like, can you? So get the archaeologists out there. Get all that work. Collect as much information as you can. The more, the better. No. The more, the worse. For Kierkegaard. Now, why? Why would that be so? Why that the more information that you have, the worse the situation would be? For him, what he feared was that when you get involved in that kind of historical study, when the thing that becomes most important is your understanding of all the details, you end up having Christianity, the teaching of Christianity, without the teacher. Without the teacher. You end up dwelling on what he said and not dwelling on what his life was like. What it cost him to say what he said. If you dwell on the, you can dwell on the doctrines, you can dwell on the words and ignore the episodes of his life. But for Kierkegaard, that only happens at your own peril. Because then the sayings of Jesus, the things that he taught, even the things that he did take on a whole different cast to them. At one place in Trained Christianity, Kierkegaard says, it's on page 27. It's on page 27, he says, that if the same words that Jesus spoke were spoken by another person, they would be false. You see how important that part was to him? For it is, he writes, the bottom of page 27, for it is untruth if I imaginally ascribe to a man words which he never uttered, affirming that he said them. But it is also untruth if I imaginally represent him as essentially different from what he was when he spoke certain words. I say essentially different. For a falsehood which has to do only with some accidental trait does not make it untrue that he said the thing. And so, when God is pleased to walk here on earth in a strict incognito, such as only an almighty being can assume, an incognito impenetrable to the most intimate observation, which it pleased him to come in the lowly form of a servant, to all appearance like any other man, and why he does it, with what purpose, he surely knows best, but whatever the reason or purpose may be, they testify that the incognito has some essential significance. When it pleases him to come in this lowly form to teach men, and then somebody repeats exactly the words he uttered, but makes it appear as if it was God that said them, instead of Jesus of Nazareth, the thing becomes untrue. For it is untrue that he uttered these words. Now, see what he's doing? He's drawing you into that, isn't he? You're saying, well, heck, isn't Jesus God? But what he's worried about is that we miss what happened to the one who said the words. What happened to him? His friends betrayed him. People spit on him. He wasn't popular. He wasn't successful in his society. And the litany goes on and on and on until you have him there hanging on a tree, dying of suffocation, when his diaphragm finally pulls loose and he can no longer breathe and he chokes to death. You miss that. And you just look at the words. You just look at the words. And if you look at the words without being close to the person. Kierkegaard's word is being contemporary with Jesus. So he kind of just spits in the eye of the historian. I'm going to be contemporary with one that lived 1900 years ago. I'm going to imagine being there right alongside of him when those things were said. And if you imagine yourself being right there alongside of him when those things are being said, then you're drawn into what happened to him who said those words. And the words become very different. Now, what's so different about it if you get drawn in? And this, I think, is the key for why knowledge demolishes Jesus Christ, why he says that line. The thing that happens is that you realize that the words were offensive. They were offensive. And the bulk of this book is trying to draw out how offensive Jesus' teachings were. You can miss it if you just look at the lines. But if you don't let those lines imaginably get embodied in the one who spoke them, and imagine yourself being there alongside of them, if you don't do that, you'll miss how offensive they were. But they were very, very offensive. They led to his death. Okay. So Kierkegaard believes. Now, what was the offense? The offense had to do both with the law that Jesus spoke and the gospel that he spoke. He's got a wonderful little text here. We'll look at it in a second. But just to give you what the pitch is. The law is offensive because it expects too much. And the gospel is offensive because it gives too little. The law is offensive because it expects too much, and the gospel is offensive because it gives too little. What is that little that it gives? The forgiveness of sins. That's too little. We want more than that. We want a life free of suffering. We want victory and triumph. We want victory over death and the grave before we die, not after we die. And on and on and on. You fill it in yourself. Or if you can't fill it in, then read Robert Schuller and he'll fill it in for you. On all that that's missing from the gospel. And so the gospel is an offense. Now that's what you see when you imagine yourself being there alongside the one who speaks those words. And then you see parts of the story. Yeah, you're not going to get any information that you didn't already have in the text. It's there, but you overlook it. But if you imagine yourself being there alongside, then you start seeing things in the trappings of the text, in the corners of the New Testament, in between the sentences that you hadn't noticed before, that fills in this offense, this scandal, this attack upon your self-esteem. Okay. Now, the text where this all comes out is on page 84. It's there for your study. In the middle of the page. The offense, in the strictest sense, offense has to do, therefore, with the God-man, and it has two forms. It either has to do with loftiness or lowliness. Okay, those are his terms. But loftiness is the law, and lowliness is the gospel. Okay. It either has to do with loftiness. One is offended at the fact that an individual man says of himself that he is God, or speaks in such a way as to betray this thought, which is dealt with under another section in this book. Or it has to do with lowliness, that he who is God is this lowly man, suffering like a lowly man. Now, in the first form of loftiness, the offense arises in such a way that I am not in the least offended at the lowliness of the man, but at the fact that he wants me to believe that he is God. And if I have believed this, the offense then arises from the other side and consists in the fact that such a one as he should be God, this lowly, helpless man who, when it comes to a test, has no power to do anything. In the one case, the point of departure is man, and the offense is the determining concept, God. In the other case, the point of departure is God, and the offense is the determining concept, man. I would guess that you think my summary was clearer than that. But it's important for you to have that experience. There's a wonderful scholar from Drew University, Naomi Leibowitz, who just published her book on Kierkegaard last year, called Kierkegaard, Louisiana State University Press put out. And in the preface of the book, she has this wonderful statement that's just as true as could be, and you wonder why it was never written before. She said, if you're going to experience the power of Kierkegaard's spirituality, you have to feel his literary style. It's a literary experience with him. You almost have to read his things out loud, because there is something awkward about them. There is something overdone about it. Something opaque, even. You know, it's not a good read like the British tell us. You know, that's a good read. Do that this summer. That's a good book. His stuff isn't a good read. At one point in this book, at the end, he says, I could never write like a journalist, because everything for them is so obvious and how unimportant. I'm talking about the bread of life, the most important, and it cannot be obvious to those of us who are not holy, who did not generate this bread of life. It's got to be angular. It has to fit somewhere. And he wanted the mode of presentation to express that. So that was kind of what I was trying to do right here for you. That lowliness and loftiness, it's about the law and the gospel. It's about the offensiveness of the law because it expects too much. This one, after all, is God. Be holy, as your Father is. Be holy. And on the other hand, I have come to forgive sins. Well, that's not enough. I want more than that. I've come to forgive sins. My grace is sufficient, Paul says, in trying to summarize that. My power is made perfect in weakness. Well, we want more than that. And so the lowliness of him is offensive. Okay, that's what happens. The offense of the whole business comes in. And this offense he elaborates in this book quite detailed. We're looking at the first half of the book, which is about 140 pages, and he spends a lot of time elaborating that offense, how it functions, and all kinds of possible reactions to it. Along the way, he attacks three types of people. He attacks pastors who want to be well-liked, so they keep receiving their paycheck and their pension fund keeps receiving its allotments. So what they do is they try to render the whole thing in terms of acceptable knowledge claims, rather than presenting you with the offense of the one who uttered the words. So he's down on preachers. He's down on bishops because they aid and abet the whole damn thing. And he's down on professors because they set a rotten model generally that knowledge is supreme. Okay. So at one point in here, he has a reaction from the professors. What would the professors say about my book? Those who are committed to the pursuit of knowledge and understanding, page 51. And the philosopher might say, such dreadful, or rather inane, vanity. For an individual man to want to be God is something hitherto unheard of. Never before has there been seen such an example of pure subjectivity and sheer negation carried to the utmost excess. He has no doctrine, no system, no fundamental knowledge. It is merely by detached, aphoristic utterances, some bits of sententious wisdom, constantly repeated with variations, that he succeeds in dazzling the masses, for whom also he performs signs and wonders, so that they, instead of learning something and receiving instruction, come to believe in him, who continues in the most odious manner possible to force his subjectivity upon them. Go your way, your faith has made you well. The most odious subjectivity upon him. There is absolutely nothing objective or positive in him, and in what he says, so far as this goes, one might say that he does not need to be brought to destruction, for philosophically considered, he is already destroyed, perishableness being the very essence of subjectivity. One may concede that his is a remarkable subjectivity, and that subjectivity is that the importance of the individual, the importance of the, what the individual thinks and feels, is more important than anything else. One may concede that he is a remarkable subjectivity, and that regarded as a teacher, he continually repeats the miracle of the five small loaves. By the aid of a little lyric and a few aphorisms, he sets the whole land in commotion. But even if one would overlook the madness revealed in the fact that he thinks himself to be God, it is an incomprehensible mistake, disclosing surely a lack of philosophical culture. To suppose that God could anyhow reveal himself in the form of a single individual. The race, the universal, the totality, that is God. But surely the race is not a single individual. In general, it is characteristic of subjectivity that the individual desires to be something of importance. But this you can understand. Insanity is evinced by the fact that the individual desires to be God. If this insane thing were possible, that an individual was God, then logically one must worship this individual. A greater philosophical bestiality cannot be conceived. So there's an offense there. And Kierkegaard doesn't want to mitigate it, but he says the church has. The church has listened to this and given in to the philosopher. Is the professor better than the unschooled person for you? Does the professor know more about Jesus than those who are not professors know? You want to find out something about Jesus? You bring in a New Testament scholar. Yeah. He'll know, won't he? He knows Greek. Right? You want to bring in an expert about Christianity, you bring in somebody with a degree from a university, right? Has Holden Village ever done that? Bring in professors? Okay, so it's that offense to the importance of knowledge. That is all important. Now, why is it important? It's important because the story then about Jesus comes to us in an indirect way. It comes to us in kind of a swirl of confusion. It can't just be laid out point blank, because then the power of it is mitigated. There was a cartoon that came out this spring sometime, and I just kicked myself every time I didn't tear it out of the magazine. Maybe I was in a dental office. They wouldn't tear it out of the magazine. I'd be a good boy. But I'd drive that wedge a little far, and I could tear it. But it was beautiful. It was Jesus at a press conference. And the cartoon had the whole press conference. Everybody's sitting there with their steno pads writing things down. And Jesus was standing there in his first century garb, and the cartoon was looking at his back. And so you saw everybody, and the line was, "Yes, I am God." They're all writing that down. Another one says he's God. Kierkegaard said it has to come indirectly. And the reason it has to come indirectly is because Jesus will only be received through faith. So that's got to be sloppy and messy, or he will not be received only by faith. If it comes, if you can program it, if you can get it on a floppy disk, then there's no need for faith. If you can get the thing spelled out so that it is intellectually acceptable, then there's no need for faith. At one point, in this opening part of Training Christianity, Kierkegaard writes that Jesus willfully keeps us at a distance. Keeps us at a distance so that in order to be received by faith, things are not crystal clear. That's why the offense is operating. He talks like, well, gee, you know, if Jesus had been born in another age, maybe the 20th century in America, we wouldn't have crucified him, would we? And he says, no. He said, no matter what age he'd been born, he would have been crucified because it was important that he'd be an offense. Well, why was it important that he'd be an offense? So that he'd be keep himself at a distance from all of us. The offensiveness of him keeps him at a distance from us so that people don't just run up and sign up and say, we're ready to renounce everything and follow you. If it were that clear, then those who come would be hollow. But if the ones who come because they know it means to be dead to the world and to pass through that offense, he talks about it, pass through the offense, then something has happened to you. You then have the mind of Christ among you. You then are a new creature. Or like Paul says, the old Adam and the old Eve has died in you, and a new Adam and a new Eve has been resurrected. Something happens to you. Here it says, everything that the bishops, the pastors, and the professors are doing are trying to keep the people from being born anew. I'm a pastor, and I know why you don't want the people to be born anew. Because then there's too much power out there. It's a confession of my sin that I don't want my parishioners to be powerful. Because, like Bob Jensen says at Gettysburg Seminary, pastors are no longer pastors, they're directors of parish affairs. And I've got so many damn things to organize and keep in. I don't need somebody rearing up and saying, we're going that way. Say, no, you're not. You're scheduled to stay here for 3 weeks and cook soup. No, we're going that way. You don't want that. Okay. So you can understand it. You can understand why that's being blocked. Seminary is the same way for me. They herd us around like a bunch of cattle. Every now and then I'd say, I don't want to be a cattle anymore. I'm sick of it. Why don't you consult me once in a while? Oh, Ron, we'd love to consult you, but God, we don't have that time. And there's all kinds of the rest. You imagine the red tape snaggle we'd be in if we had to do that? You can sympathize? I said, no, I can't. I think we ought to close the seminary down then. The only way people can get through is cows, then it should be closed down. Again, you see, the importance of the individual. Because there's power there. The mind of Christ then So that's why Jesus keeps things at a distance. That's why the communication is indirect. If my 2.5-year-old wasn't sick today, I would have been at Ruth's Bible study. But didn't she talk about the incognito in Mark? See, it's the same thing that Kierkegaard is appealing to here. And that's not by accident. It's not altogether because of the stupidity of Mark's disciples. It's by design. There's got to be that distance. There's got to be that gap so that you venture out. You pass through this offense. You die. See, you're not going to die otherwise. The whole thing's laid out for you on a floppy disk. You don't have to die. You just pay your money, take it, and away you go. That was easy. Stuff in your pocket. Now we're Christians. Now we're following Jesus. There's got to be that trauma there. All right, the two little passages. Look at the little one here from the journals. Late, huh? He's almost dead. He dies November 11th, the day Martin Luther was baptized. A Christian is a man of will who has acquired a new will. A Christian is a man of will who no longer wills his own will, but with the passion of his crushed will. Look at that. But with the passion of his crushed will, radically changed, wills another's will. That's an interesting description of what it's like to have the old Eve die in you and the new Eve to be resurrected. With the passion of the crushed will another's will. To follow the Christ. A man of understanding can never become a Christian. A man of understanding can never become a Christian. The most he can achieve through the power of imagination is to play with the Christian problem. I played with Christian problems for years, and I still play with them. Another point, Kierkegaard says, you know what happens when a lark wants to fart like an elephant? It blows up! And that's what happens to you if you think the understanding is the most important thing. You too will blow up! If you don't believe that the pursuit for understanding is what he calls an unassuming triviality, it's just a thought game. Bonhoeffer said, you want to be a Christian, when Jesus calls you to come, he says, come and die. See, that's not playing with the Christian problems. Consequently, Christianity, becoming a Christian, is not at all related to transforming the intellect. Really? Consequently, Christianity, becoming a Christian, is not at all related to transforming the intellect. I remember one of my seminary professors said, sin's got to have a cognitive element to it. I said, why does sin have to have a cognitive? I mean, what do you mean? Well, God, if it doesn't have a cognitive element to it, then I don't know why we've got a seminary. I mean, we're all here trying to get everybody's head straight. And hopefully it has something to do with our sin. So it's mitigating sin and we can justify being here. A lot at stake. Sin's got to have a cognitive element. Because then if you can straighten out your intellectual problems, your sin will reduce, you see? And then you've got a rationale for being a seminary of the church. What do? We reduce sin over here. What do? Oh, thank God for the seminary. Somebody's reducing sin. See? Kierkegaard says, consequently, Christianity, becoming a Christian, is not at all related to the transforming of the intellect. Sin doesn't have a cognitive element, intellectual element, but to transforming of the will. I don't follow Jesus because I'm a coward and I've got too much to lose. I've got a bank account. I've got a savings account. I've got a pension fund. I've got books. You believe my library. Wonderful library. We've got a piano in our house, a harpsichord. We've got all kinds of stuff. I don't follow Jesus because it costs too much. Too much to lose. But this transformation, the will, is the most painful of all operations. Yes, it would be. If you got a lot to lose, it would be painful. The most painful of all operations, comparable to a vivisection. Yes. Yes, it would. You know what vivisection? You have any animal rights people here? That's where they dissect a living creature without any anesthesia. They just put that monkey up there and cut him open alive and see how everything's working in there. The most painful of all, comparable to a vivisection. Anybody want to have one of those later? The right to which is ethically dubious. And because it is so appalling, to become a Christian has changed long ago. Look at that line. And because it's so appalling, Christianity, to become a Christian was changed long ago in Christendom into a remodeling of the intellect. What do we do now?
Okay, kids, you're in seventh grade. Stand in front of the church and tell us what you know.
Did you hear Garrison Keillor on that, his little ditty on Confirmation Sunday? Did you hear we asked these little kids to get up there and give definitive answers for the most complex theological questions that have baffled the likes of Aquinas? And to do it by memory in 5 minutes! And because it is so appalling, to become a Christian was changed long ago in Christendom into a remodeling of the intellect, insofar as it is not made into something utterly meaningless, something one is automatically. Okay. Then the stuff on death. Okay, I mean, this whole thing. Why does Jesus keep it as distance? The wedge is driven between Christian faith and knowledge in order to have this distance between the believer and the Christ. And that distance is there so that we'll die and be born again. So something different will happen to us when we become a Christian. It's not like going out and buying a new pair of Levi's. Hey, I'm a Christian today. Picked up, you know, the four spiritual truths. We're there. Or Luther's catechism. We're there. Got it. No, you've got to die, he says. Look at the first one. Thoughts on death. Christianity took away the fear of death and replaced it with resurrection from the dead? No. Wouldn't that what Jesus said? No. Christianity took away the fear of death and replaced it with fear of judgment. Gave you something more to fear than death. Judgment. This is the sharpening, but it is a step forward as well. We cannot scientifically get into our heads that spiritually a genuine step forward is recognizable by it being a sharpening. Spiritually, no step forward is truly made in which the matter becomes easier. No, what makes the matter easier is not a step forward, no matter how much it is trumpeted as being this. And then he has a little thing here on what it means to die to the world. To die, too, means to regard everything as one will see it at the moment of death. And consequently, to bring death as close as possible. Even the most dazzling and enchanting pleasure, in the moment of death, will it not be a matter of complete unconcern whether you enjoyed it or not? On the other hand, every good work, yes, for God and heaven's sake, do not neglect to do it. In the hour of death, it will be of utmost urgency that you did not neglect it. Alas. Who has achieved this?